This is the third day of this November 2009 seven-day session. And we'll resume reading from the teachings of Shu Yun, the 19th and 20th century Chan master. We're reading from a book called Chan and Zen Teaching, first series. And we're now at a beginning of a chapter called Chan Training, Master Shu Yun's Discourse in the Chan Hall. Let me read his prefatory words just to give a flavor of the Chinese and Japanese appreciation of self-effacement. I'll just do this quickly. Dear friends, you have been coming frequently to ask for my instruction, and I really feel ashamed of my incompetence. Every day from morning to evening, you have been all hard at work, splitting firewood, tilling the fields, moving earth, and carrying bricks. In spite of this, you still remember your religious duties. This earnestness of yours does indeed warm the heart of other people. I, Shu Yun, feel really ashamed of my incompetence in religion and lack of virtue. I am not qualified to give instruction and can only pick up a few sentences left behind by the ancients in reply to your questions. This is very much respected in Asia. It's sort of the opposite of the United States, where self-promotion is considered perfectly okay. Here it's to speak of one's deficits, of one's how far one still has to go. It may not be purely a matter of form. I find myself that the further I go in practice, the more conspicuous my ongoing how conspicuous the work yet to be done becomes. Residual defilements, habit forces. So there may be some sincerity in what he's saying. I think of something Carl Jung once said, where the light is at its brightest, the shadows are deepest. And then he begins. Prerequisites of the fulfillment of religious duty. Religious duty is not the best sounding phrase. I think the translator could have done better, but I haven't taken the time to think of something better. Might say prerequisites for the fulfillment of spiritual vows. Number one, firm belief in the law of causality. Whoever one may be, especially if striving to fulfill one's spiritual vows, one should believe firmly in the law of causality. If one lacks this belief and does whatever one likes, not only will one fail, but also there will be no escape from this law of causality. This this is so true, what he says, if we can truly believe in causation, that what we do will have consequences, for better or for worse, then this goes a long way toward fueling a pure aspiration. But I think it's quite unusual that someone would really fully believe in causality. Someone who did fully believe in causality would not be ever likely to break any of the precepts. One wouldn't try to get away with anything, knowing that it'll catch up with us sooner or later. And it would definitely sober us as to the precious time that is passing moment by moment. Then he quotes the Buddha, "If one wishes to know the causes formed in a previous life, one can find them in how one fares in the present life. If one wishes to know the effects in the next life, one can find them in one's deeds in the present life." The way I've always heard this passage by the Buddha was, if you want to know, the context, as I've always heard it, was a follower asks the Buddha what he'll be in his next life. And the Buddha said, "If you want to know what you were in the past, look at yourself now. If you want to know what you'll be in the future, look at yourself now." And that's what we do in practice. We're looking at this mind right now. And what we find there, what is revealed in terms of our conditioning, our obstructions, our strengths as well as our weaknesses, all of these things, they are both the effect of previous causes, previous lives, I would say, and also the seeds of future karma. In other words, everything comes down to this moment, and this moment, this, how we're using or misusing the mind. It's utterly futile to sit and think about the past or the future in terms of our lives or what we may have been and may be in the future. We don't need to. Just look at what we have right now. Look at who we are right now. There it is. Shuyun says, he also said, "The karma of our deeds will never be wiped out even after hundreds and thousands of eons. As soon as conditions become ripe, we will have to bear the effects ourselves." And he quotes the Sharangama Sutra, one of the most, one of the major Mahayana sutras, and one that is very much respected in the Zen school. The Sharangama Sutra says, "If the causal ground is flawed, the ripening fruit will be flawed." And then Shuyun says, "Therefore, when one sows a good cause, one will reap a wholesome fruit. And when one sows a corrupt cause, one will reap an unwholesome fruit. When one sows melon seeds, one will gather melons. And when one sows beans, one will gather beans. This is the plain truth. as I am talking about the law of causality, I will tell you two stories. I'm not going to read these stories. They're very long, and period. They're just too much to read. So there it is. There it is, as plain as can be. Our actions, our words, and our thoughts right now and now are determining, not absolutely, not as something that is immutable. That's a common misunderstanding. But to a great extent, they're determining, let's put it this way, they're determining what we will have to deal with in the future. But the good news is that this karma, again, is not immutable. It is something we can reshape to some extent. We can work with it, and at all times we can have some effect on this karma of ours. That's the whole point of spiritual practice. So we're not just stuck with the past, just playing out in a way that is beyond our reach. Yes, what we've done in the past, we will now have to contend with. But in our practice, we can find the resources to work with the effects of our past deeds and so forth, to work more effectively so that we don't suffer in the same way as if we weren't practicing. So that was the first prerequisite of the fulfillment of spiritual vows, firm belief in the law of causality, karma. The second, he says, is strict observance of the rules of discipline. Rules of discipline, probably by that he means the precepts. In striving to fulfill one's spiritual vows, the first thing is to uphold the rules of discipline. For discipline is the fundamental of the supreme bodhi, that is, supreme wisdom. Discipline begets immutability, and immutability begets wisdom. Immutability here would be composure or an equanimity, I think, is one way to see it. That our upholding the precepts grounds us in something steadfast and unwavering. He goes on, there is no such thing as practice without upholding the rules of discipline. The Sharangama Sutra, which lists four kinds of purity, clearly teaches us that cultivation of samadhi without upholding the rules of discipline will not wipe out the dust, that is, the impurities of our character, our mind. We have a Jukai ceremony coming up in a little more than a couple weeks. We have this of this prominence. We have Jukai only once a year, the weekend of Thanksgiving, and it's a chance to wipe the slate clean and start afresh with by vocalizing our determination to uphold these precepts, not just to be good little boys and girls, but as a way to live in accord with our nature. That's really what the precepts, upholding the precepts, comes down with, to. They describe our fundamental nature, the behavior of one who is living in accord with our fundamental nature. And so to the degree that we can uphold them and live in harmony with these precepts, we will be basically living like a Buddha, living out of our Buddha nature. It also is a wonderful way to simplify one's life and avoid the kinds of complications that cause us so much distress unnecessarily. And then he presents some words of the sixth patriarch, who said, "Why should discipline be observed if the mind is already impartial? Why should straightforward men practice chan?" I would say that the sixth patriarch is pointing to our fundamental purity, the purity of our fundamental mind. He's making the point that if we live out of this true nature of ours, then we don't have to concern ourselves with staying within a fence made up of the precepts. And if we are in accord with this upright mind of ours that we are endowed with naturally, why even practice chan? And now the Shu Yun takes that quote. He says, "If you retort and ask me why the sixth patriarch said these words, I will ask you back this question. Is your mind already impartial and straightforward?" Impartial and straightforward would also mean grounded in perfect composure and equanimity. Equanimity meaning an evenness, a deep anchoring in the absolute, in which nothing can cause us distress, and where we see everything with the mind of equality. This is to be thoroughly established in the essential, the fundamental. Is your mind already impartial and straightforward? If the lady Chang O came down from the moon with her naked body and embraced you in her arms, would your heart remain undisturbed? And if someone without any reason insults and beats you, will you not give rise to feelings of anger and resentment? Can you refrain from differentiating between ill will and affection, between hate and love, between self and other, between right and wrong? If you can do all this, then you can open your mouth widely to talk. Otherwise, it is useless to tell a deliberate lie." I'm reminded of a question that came up, a whole topic that came up in a small conference with the Dalai Lama that I attended, of Western Buddhist teachers, about 25 of us, and we were telling him of the troubling number of Buddhist teachers, both Zen and Tibetan Buddhist teachers, the number of Buddhist teachers in the West, the Americas and Europe, who blatantly flaunt, blatantly violate precepts, particularly of alcohol and sexual involvements with their students. And the one person said that these teachers who do this claim that this is just the functioning of crazy wisdom. The idea being that when you've so transcended ordinary conventional notions of right and wrong that you can freely play out whatever you want, sporting in the world of phenomena, and there is, it's just all the expression of profound wisdom, crazy wisdom, let's say. And he scoffed at that and said that there's an understanding in his lineage of Tibetan Buddhism that if one has such detachment and such has attained such a degree of impartiality, to use Xu Yun's word here, such a state of detachment and impartiality that one could as easily drink one's own urine or eat one's own feces as drinking water or eating bread, then yes, one has reached the stage where one can play out all of these things sexually and through alcohol, and you could say that that is the functioning of crazy wisdom. But then he said, interestingly, there are only two lamas I personally know who have reached such a depth of realization, and they're both hermits. He motioned, pointed behind him to the foothills of the Himalayas. He said, they're both hermits, and they are just sterling in their upholding of the precepts. And then the third, he presents the third prerequisite of the fulfillment of spiritual vows, and that is a firm faith. A firm believing mind is the fundamental of one's training for fulfilling one's spiritual vows, because faith is the mother of the source of right doctrine, and because without faith, no good will derive therefrom. If we want to be liberated from the round of births and deaths, we must first have a firm believing mind. Believing what? And then he says, the Buddha said that all living beings on earth had inherent in them the meritorious Tathagata wisdom, which they could not realize solely because of their false thinking and grasping. Why have we failed to attain Buddhahood, enlightenment? It is because we have not gone into training according to the correct method. For example, we believe and know that tofu can be made with soybean, but if we do not start making it, soybean cannot turn into tofu. Now, assuming that soybean is used for making tofu, we shall still fail to make it if we do not know how to mix it. If we do not know how to mix it with gypsum, if we know the method, we will grind the soybean, put the powder in water, boil it, take out the bean grounds, and add a suitable quantity of gypsum powder. Thus, we will certainly get tofu. Likewise, in the performance of our spiritual vows, enlightenment will be unattainable not only because of lack of training, but also because of training that is not in conformity with the correct method. If our practice is practiced according to the correct method, without either backsliding or regret, we are bound to attain Buddhahood. We are bound to attain Buddhahood. He doesn't say when, but yes, we are bound to attain Buddhahood. Roshi Kaplow used to say often in many sesshins that the one thing we have to have faith in Zen is that when the Buddha said that what is common to all of us is this enlightened nature, that he wasn't mistaken and he wasn't lying. In other words, we need to have faith that enlightenment is our nature. That despite everything we see in ourselves, despite our reactions day in and day out, despite all the ways that we, yes, the ways that we violate the precepts, nonetheless, there is just this enlightened nature. And the degree to which we can embrace that and have faith in that will, to a great extent, fuel our practice. If we think we're just losers or jerks, then our practice is going to be crippled to a certain extent. This also is why the precepts are so important, because if we're living in harmony with the precepts, then we have solid evidence that we are essentially whole and complete and endowed with wisdom and compassion and virtue, because that's how we're leading our lives. If we're, on the other hand, if we're violating precepts, then it's going to be harder to believe in our inherent nobility. I would say, though, that even that article of faith in our own Buddha nature, our own enlightened nature, that even that, strictly speaking, is not necessary. What's necessary is to empty the mind of all notions, to reach a samadhi, and from that condition of samadhi, of oneness, awakening can arise. We see supportive evidence of this in those very rare stories of those who have come to spontaneous enlightenment experiences. I always think first of Flora Courtois, a woman who, as a college student in the 1940s, was suddenly gripped by the question, what is real? Now, this is someone who knew nothing about Buddhism, nothing about enlightenment, she says in her autobiography, nothing about any of that. So clearly she hadn't established any faith in her enlightened nature, because she didn't know what enlightenment was. Even after it happened to her, she was left completely confounded by the change that happened. And yet what she did have was this questioning that drew her deep into a state of samadhi. And out of that came her enlightenment. I think what Roshi Kaplow meant was that we have to have enough faith in the practice to do it. We have to have enough faith that it'll work somehow, that it's true in order to do it. That's basically all we need. We have to do it. It's not a belief system, basically. It is a practice. That's what changes us. We don't go through change based on our beliefs. We go through change based on a body-mind practice. It's the same with anything. Yoga. We can't just believe in the postures of yoga. We have to do them. We can't just believe that flossing will be good for our teeth. We have to do it. So we come to Sesshin. Everyone who comes to Sesshin surely is endowed with this faith. It may be for some more solid, more deep than others, but the very doing of the practice deepens the faith. It develops it. And so, fundamentally in Zen, faith is a matter of experience. In that way, it's different from belief. Belief can be something we've never experienced, but faith, in its truest form, in its essence, is based on experience. The more we can experience this realm of mind that is beyond thought, the more we tend to have faith in it, that there is something beyond this whole world of thoughts and concepts, that is something beyond the world of self and other. And so, again, he says, if our practice is done according to the correct method, without either backsliding or regret, we are bound to attain enlightenment. Therefore, we should firmly believe that fundamentally we are Buddhas. We are enlightened ones. We should also firmly believe that practice performed according to the correct method is bound to result in the attainment of Buddhahood. The problem is that people sometimes lose faith and then quit practice. Over the years, I've seen this done not often by people who've gone to many sesshins, but there have been cases. I remember being so startled by hearing that someone on staff in the 1970s who had gone to, I don't know, 10, 15 sesshins, 20 maybe, suddenly left. Now, all right, I don't know that he stopped sitting. He just left staff and disappeared. This too, this loss of faith, is the effect of some previous cause, some obstruction in the mind, where we convince ourselves that it's just not working and it can't work. And then he speaks of the adoption of a method of training. After one has developed a firm faith, one should choose a Dharma door to enlightenment for one's training. He means a practice, either Zen or Pure Land practice or Tibetan Buddhism, one of the different teachings of the Dharma. One should choose a Dharma door to enlightenment for one's training. One should never change it. And when one's choice has been made, either for repetition of the Buddha's name or for holding a mantra or for chan training, one should stick to it forever without backsliding and regret. If today the method does not prove successful, tomorrow it shall be continued. If this year it does not prove successful, next year it shall be continued. And if in the present lifetime it does not prove successful, it shall be continued in the next life. The old master Kuai Shan said, if one practices it in each succeeding reincarnation, the Buddha stage can be expected. And then Shu Yun says, there are some people who are irresolute in their decisions. Today, after hearing a learned person praise the repetition of Buddha's name, they decide to repeat it for a couple of days. And tomorrow, after hearing another learned man praise Chan training, they will try it for another 2 days. If they like to play in this manner, they will go on doing so until their death without succeeding in getting any result. Is it not a pity? So these different approaches appeal to different people. And we have different temperaments, and we will find an affinity with Zen over Tibetan Buddhism or vice versa. Pure Land over Nichiren. But if we have gone down the road of one practice long enough to have really gotten seasoned at it, then the best thing is to persevere through thick and thin, through doubts that may come up. When you read the stories of the masters, almost all of them, or at least an awful lot of them, were tormented by doubts at some point in their practice. But somehow they dug deep and found the resources to persevere through the doubts. Because the doubts are just thoughts. Doubts are thoughts. Please remember this as Sesshin goes on, because the ego can kick back and throw up all kinds of doubts in our mind as Sesshin goes on. They're thoughts. Thoughts aren't worth squat. Don't listen to them. Skipping a few pages, and he talks about the earnestness to leave samsara and develop a long, enduring mind. In Chan training, one should be in earnest in one's desire to leave the realm of birth and death and develop a long, enduring mind in one's striving. I remember when I used to hear Roshi Kaplow read these phrases in Taisho, A phrase such as to the desire to leave the realm of birth and death. I had trouble relating to that. I had had a pretty happy life, and I didn't see what was so bad about birth and death. Well, birth. I don't see what was so bad about birth and death at that age. You know, when you're young, as Andy Rooney said, to the young, death is but a distant rumor. And it was just an abstraction. Yeah, death, whatever, you know. Whatever, death, yeah. But birth, life, yeah, whew, give me more of that. And it was hard for me to relate to that, getting off the wheel of life and death, escaping the wheel of samsara. But it helps to, instead of just this abstraction of leave the realm of birth and death, just think of suffering, leaving the realm of suffering, leaving the realm of self-consciousness, painful self-consciousness, leaving the realm of difficult, painful relationships, leaving the realm where we can't get what we want, and we have to be with people we don't like, and we can't be with people we want to be with. If necessary, reflect on how things went for you when you were a teenager. You want to go through that again? He goes on, if the mind is not earnest, it will be impossible to give rise to the doubt. Doubt meaning the doubt sensation, questioning. And the striving will be ineffective. Lack of a long, enduring mind will result in laziness, and the training will not be continuous. Think of this phrase, long, enduring mind. Think of it as taking the long view, not just wanting to grab something and run, not wanting to just get a quick fix, but taking the long view as to really tearing down and rebuilding our whole character structure, refining the personality, purifying the mind in every subtle way. He says, just develop a long, enduring mind and the doubt will rise of itself. When doubt rises, again, doubt here means questioning. When doubt rises, trouble will come to an end of itself. As the ripe moment comes, it will be like running water, which will form a channel. And then he launches into a story that we'll save for tomorrow. And we'll stop now and recite the four vows.